Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. My name is Michelle W. Malkin. I'm your host. And today I am in conversation with Audra Berg, who is the president and CEO at the Jewish Federation of Broward County. I'll let her tell you more about her background, but Audra and I met in the Leading Edge cohort for Leading Executives training program. And, you know, we were having a variety of conversations throughout the cohort. And near the end, I shared some challenges I was having with my lay relationships. And she sent me a quick message and said, let's talk about that. And so I said, yes, let's talk about that and let's do it publicly. So I'm so excited to be talking with her and bringing her on the program today. Audra, welcome.
Thank you. This is my first podcast.
Oh, awesome.
Yay!
I'm happy to be the first, but most people might, you know, read your bio. I found out I'm really bad at that. So I'd love to just hear from you how you found yourself in this position.
Great. So pretty much my whole career has been in Jewish communal life, primarily in federations. Broward County is Fort Lauderdale, for those of you who are not aware. Fort Lauderdale is the eighth largest Jewish community in the country. It's where I grew up. I was born in New Jersey, actually, just down the street from where you are now. I think I consider myself a New Yorker in my mind. My parents are New Yorkers, and I moved to South Florida for middle school and high school. But I left after college. I went to the University of Florida, go Gators, and I moved to Chicago. And I had the privilege of starting my career at the Federation of Chicago, which is called JUF, the Jewish United Fund. And I started in young leadership. I was there for 3 years. Then I did capital and endowment fundraising for agency partners. Later went on to work for the National System, so the predecessor organization of the Jewish Federations of North America, which is called UJC, or the United Jewish Communities. I ran National Young Leadership Cabinet. By far the best job I ever had. It was terrific. And during that time, a few things happened. My now husband went to business school at Michigan. Go Blue, and UJC closed the regional offices. So I was in Ann Arbor for a period working for UJC, and then I moved to New York while he was finishing up grad school. And I did a few different things, all within the Jewish community in New York, and then ultimately moved back to Chicago to continue my career at JUF, overseeing governance, lay leadership development. And no one in Chicago had previously had a job exclusively dedicated to leadership development, which was interesting because the Chicago Federation is enormous, 27 committees, 100 and something people on the board, a huge infrastructure in terms of agency relationships and leadership. Right. I really had the opportunity to build something there and I loved it. And it was great. And JUF gave me every opportunity to see the world, to advance. I was very involved and ultimately became board chair of JPRO, which is the professional association for people who...
I think, did I read the first female non-CEO board of JPRO?
Yes, there were previously women,
excellent.
Women who were board chairs, but I was the first who wasn't a CEO.
Right.
And so I loved every minute of working at JUF and I thought I'd be there forever. Mm-hmm. And then COVID happened. There was, I was starting to get bored at JUF. You know, there were sort of 12 people who oversaw every area of work there and everyone stayed in their lane. Mm-hmm. And I was getting a little bored after so many years staying in the same lane. And I was always ambitious and I always wanted to lead and do more. And I found a number of ways to do that within the space. But then it was COVID and we spent a lot of time with our family down in Florida during those few years. And my kids went to an overnight camp in the Southeast. So they had friends here. And then out of the blue, I get a call about this job. Mm-hmm. And my entire career, the Broward County Federation had really not been on my radar. I have friends in Boca, friends in Miami, friends in Palm Beach, Federation colleagues all around the system who I know and love. But this federation has really been under the radar, but it's my hometown. It's where my family lives. And, you know, 6 months later, here I was. So I started in as CEO in February of 22. My family followed later that summer. And here we are.
That's wonderful. And so did you always know you wanted to be a Jewish professional working in these spaces? Like, what was that first spark for you that you're like, yeah, this feels like a good career path for me?
Mm-hmm. So I did not grow up in a philanthropic family, but I grew up in a Jewishly engaged family. We were active in our synagogue. I went to Jewish overnight camp, youth group. I've always been a joiner. Mm. And like my sister wouldn't have the same story that I have, but I always looked for opportunities to engage. But I was planning on being a business major and never knew that this kind of thing existed as a career. In fact, my mother told me this is, you know, what women did on Tuesdays at lunch. This was not a job, but she certainly would not have known. And I did not grow up with a mother who had a career.
Right.
And I was confirmed. And I don't even know if being confirmed is like a thing anymore because it wasn't in Chicago.
Right.
I think it is in other places, but I was confirmed. And after I was confirmed, I went to Hebrew high school and I had the opportunity to get to know my professor, who, by the way, is still, you know, very active in our community. Mm. And I was sort of inspired to learn more. I actually dated an evangelical guy in high school.
Mm.
I was really sort of just engaged in understanding religion and people of faith. And it just was exciting to me. And I went to college and in order to major in Jewish studies, you had to take however many years of Hebrew, which I promptly failed out of.
Yeah.
Switched my major to religion. And as soon as I graduated college, I knew I was moving to Chicago. And I don't know how I knew, but something in me said, you should go work at the Federation. And I applied for a job. I interviewed and I started working there 2 weeks later.
That's awesome. And the rest is history.
But I was in a Jewish sorority in college. And I think for sure that set me on a path towards caring about Jewish community, towards caring about community, bringing people together. It was just something that really blossomed during those years.
Yeah. A lot of similarities I'm seeing that I never really, you know, would have known about you. I mean, I was also a religious studies major, which I have, and Jewish studies minor, which was interesting. But it's funny you say you're always a joiner. I went to Indigo Girls concert recently. And the people I went with were like, oh, are you fans? What's your favorite song? I was like, no, my friend asked me to go. So I was like, sure. So similarly of the, you know, kind of following life where it takes you and then finding yourself in this position. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your specific Jewish Federation, the work that happens in Broward County, and then on a kind of dovetail on that, your expectations, right? You were offered this job kind of out of the blue. You moved your whole family from Chicago to Florida. And I'm sure you came into the job with a certain level of expectations and how that's changed over the year and a half that you've been in the job.
Mm-hmm. Well, so first of all, I'm having a blast. Every day is not perfect for sure, but overall I'm having fun. And that is because this is a really wonderful community. Mm. And I would not have taken the job if all of the right elements for success didn't exist here. And, you know, we had the opportunity to get to know some colleagues in the CEO program that we were in, and they were telling me about their organization and, you know, the debt and the staffing inadequacies and the difficult leadership. And all I'm thinking is, why did you take that job? I was very honest during, you know, the many, many interviews I had with different stakeholders, with the board, with the search committee, about what I thought the opportunities were to be better, where I thought, you know, organizationally some bad decisions had been made, where things needed to be fixed. And the community has been very open to it. Mm. Listen, everybody knows that the changing nature of our country's demographics as a result of COVID have led to a dramatic shift in the population in South Florida.
Right.
I just read yesterday in the newspaper that you have to be making $100,000 a year to be able to afford to rent an apartment in Broward County.
Wow.
And the average age, you know, South Florida is an enormous Jewish community. There are 4 federations here.
Mm-hmm.
In February, there's like 1.25 million Jews in South Florida. So there is tons of opportunity here. There's a really good professional team. We are the 8th largest federation in terms of total assets, which is very significant. We have no debts. We generally tend to hire people easily and effectively.
That's great.
Just because there's so many people here engaged in Jewish life. So there is a willingness to understand, to be better, to serve a broader proportion of the community than we have been. We're surrounded by very successful federations. We absolutely need to be better in terms of raising more annual campaign dollars, and we absolutely need to be better in engaging more people in Jewish life. And a lot of people think federations are fundraising organizations. We're not. You know, we're community building organizations, and we do that by engaging people in Jewish life and helping people to feel a part of something collective where they're contributing to the safety and security and future of our Jewish community. And that's what we do. And I'm very fortunate to have terrific volunteer leadership, generous donors who are on board with thinking bigger and differently, and a really committed professional team who's on this journey with me. And as a result, we are starting to raise more money. We're changing our governance. We're going to be going on a community listening tour next year.
Nice.
And our allocations process as a result of that. So we're building, you know, relationships with agency partners, I think, that have been neglected. And so it's a lot, you know, it's a lot. But it's really exciting. And I feel like we're in a position to really make a difference.
Yeah. Now, did you know that it was going to be a lot when you came in? I assume you asked what their, you know, what their budget was. But, you know, did you expect that the staff were going to be? I mean, you said you did all these kind of interviews and stuff. So you're saying it was pretty much exactly what you expected when you walked into the role, what you were finding yourself.
Yeah, I do think it's what I expected. I continue to be surprised by things every day. And there, you know, I came from the preeminent federation in the system. You know, there's like two or three federations that are like the Chicago Federation. Chicago has a $90 million annual campaign from, 285,000 Jews, and they raise another $50 to $60 million on top of that from capital endowment grants. It's extraordinary, you know, almost 400 employees. So coming from that to a federation with 50 employees is a very different thing. But what I wanted for myself was to have the experience to be able to make a difference across different areas. And having come out of a federation like the one I did, where I was privileged to be on the senior management team, it is shocking how much I know just about every area of work. So Israel, allocations, Jewish education, campus, anti-Semitism, there's a lot that the expectations on a federation CEO to be knowledgeable about literally a dozen different areas and maintain community partnerships and donors. And it's really extraordinary. So it's not like I didn't know. You know, I sat, you know, watching Steve Nassiter, who built the Chicago Federation, was the CEO for 35 years. You know, I sat next to him for much of the last 15 years. So I came into this job knowing exactly what I needed to know, but it's still, it is awe-inspiring, truthfully, to have this responsibility and to be at the helm of a community where everyone is looking to you to set the tone. Right. And so I think it is what I expected broadly, but certainly experiencing it day in and day out, you know, has its moments.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's actually a really good resource. I'm not sure if you're aware, but that Leading Edge put out, basically to give people a sense of a fit when it comes to taking on a CEO role. And, you know, these are the questions you should be asking. These are the things you should know about the organization. These are things to consider about whether or not, you know, I think in all other roles, you know, you're looking for a new job or, you know, got laid off or whatever the situation is. And you're like, oh, that seems interesting. Goes up my alley. I could do these things, right? You interview, you get the job, you know, you move on and doing the job. And I think with these roles, you know, there's definitely started to be a realization of like, it's a different kind of role. And even if, you know, the organization likes you and wants to hire you, you know, the person themselves has to be cognizant of whether it's a good fit, because that's really, you know, puts a lot of emphasis on how that is going to be a successful relationship. And, you know, with your ambition and, you know, my ambition, and I'm sure a lot of other people's ambitions to be in a role and lead at that level, you know, just doing it anywhere, you know, is not always going to be a good situation, but to really be thinking in a lot of different ways of, is this a good fit? Is this what, you know, my specific talents and my specific outlook and the way that I like to operate going to be embraced where I'm going, where I can actually make the change that I want to make and help make this the organization successful. Because if you compromise on those things, you're going to end up, you know, pretty unhappy in that situation.
Right. So a few thoughts on that. One, I am extremely fortunate to have found myself sort of in the Federation sphere. Mm-hmm. I was sort of kidding that it was same job, you know, warmer climate.
Right.
So many things are the same. It is true that federations are different and have different complexities. And obviously so much is different here than in Chicago. But at the end of the day, we do the same things. We have the same values. And it really did not feel like such a huge transition. You know, mm-hmm. even the people, they feel like the same kind of people.
Right.
I think had I gone to a federation that has a more alternative worldview, like Denver or San Francisco, I think I would have been in for a shock. But I knew going in after, you know, I'd had a chance to do my research that the community was very much what I would have wanted and what I was used to. So there's that. And the second thing I'll say, and this is something, you know, I think people, maybe especially women, aren't always as good at that I have really tried to stick to, which is that I really am my authentic self. And so when I was interviewing for the job, I was very honest about what I thought was problematic here, what I thought the opportunities were, and what I thought we needed to do to be successful. And I continue to stick to that. So I'll be sitting in a meeting with lay leadership, and I will say, I just want to remind you that this is an area of work where we are not doing our best. And it is, you know, we can't fix everything at once, but I'm very honest about what's not working and what needs to be different and what, and I'm not pretending, you know, that it's all rosy with my volunteers. And so I think that's given them a lot of confidence in me and that I'm, you know, I am truly being my authentic self and honest with them about what I think is possible and what's not.
Yeah. So that's actually a great transition into why I brought you here in the first place. And so for the last many, many years in your work with the Chicago Federation was working with the board, was working with leadership, was working development. Now, I happen to sit in a very different seat, sitting is in a synagogue environment in which I was actually just talking to our incoming first vice president this morning that, you know, you have donors and then your staff and then the people that you serve, right? The institutions that you give money to, that kind of stuff. And in my scenario, the people that we serve are the same people who are our donors and decision makers. And there's a lot of ownership feelings that kind of go into it. And so generally, you know, the conversation I want to have, and it's not the conversations I've had with people that have led to our conversations aren't just in the synagogue world, right? There's been, you know, lots of scenarios in terms of, you know, people not being let go because they have a good relationship with the board chair, even though they're doing a bad job, where somebody on a board will say, I don't like the way that staff member's voice sounds, or, you know, this person needs to start code switching between the way they talk to men and the way they talk to women, because, you know, women are seeing them in a different way in their leadership. You know, it kind of just pops up all over the place, this just power dynamic between the sort of relationship of the staff and the relationship of the donors and the volunteers in saying, you know, both who has the power here to make decisions, whose opinion is more valued, how should, you know, a staff person who very much wants to serve, right, very much wants to be, you know, useful in the community, but not seen as a servant, right, not seen as the, you know, quote unquote puppet for the, you know, these board members or these donors to just do what they say. And I think sometimes the fight for just CEOs or staff people in general to say, I have a valued voice, like I am a professional, I have trained, I'm in networks, I'm in workshops, you know, this is my day-to-day work. And I get that you're a CFO of, you know, some organization and you think, you know, best for this organization, but it's a collaboration of conversation that I think that sort of mutual respect in nonprofits is tricky to train and tricky to change into a culture and tricky to navigate when that presents itself. So that's the overarching thing. And so I'd love to hear a little bit first about what your work looked like when you were there in terms of speaking at conferences. What was your pitch? What was your basic 1, 2, 3 points of those relationships? And then, you know, obviously launch into just general sort of advice when either sort of confronted with these power dynamic struggles, or just generally starting a new job and having lay leaders that you're working with. How do you make sure that, you know, that communication and relationship is really positive so that when you do hit bumps in the road, it's not derailing?
Right. So that's a lot.
some time.
I mean, it's my favorite topic. So I'm happy to have, you know, a conversation about it. It is definitely more art than science. Mm-hmm. It is a very hard thing to teach. And I do think that the people who are successful in nonprofit work are the people who figure this out early in their career.
Right.
And when, you know, after 3 years is a big transition time. And I think that's a time where we see the people who couldn't figure this role out. And obviously, as nonprofit organizations become even more professionalized and more specialized over time, not everybody is working with volunteers in the same way. But right. I do, you know, I've always thought that if you're going to work in a nonprofit organization, one, you have to be comfortable working with volunteer leadership. And two, you have to think of yourself as a fundraiser, because every nonprofit relies on donations, and we're all representatives of the organization, whether we're in a fundraising role or not. And truthfully, those two things, you know, are sort of linked in a lot of ways. I think the first thing is it's really important for the professional to always come across as confident and prepared.
Mm.
I think where we start to get into trouble is when the professional sort of sets the tone to the relationship in a deferential role.
Mm.
I think it's really important from the outset to own who you are, your experience, what you bring to the conversation. And I think that was harder 30 years ago when I started my career. And I think over time I have seen in the field, especially for early career professionals, that it is easier now because our society has changed a bit in a positive direction in this
right.
way of being more aware of treating people with respect. So I think if you come to the relationship with what you bring to it, you're starting yourself off on a good foot. I also don't think that there's a recipe to follow for a lay professional dynamic. I think you have to sort of know your audience and what you bring to the table and what they bring to the table. So, you know, mm-hmm. when I started, I think there was the professional writes the agenda for the meeting and the volunteer runs the meeting. And I think now that there's a lot more nuance. I mean, I've worked with volunteers who are amazing at creating agendas and like really mm-hmm. thought partners in doing that work. And I have never, even from early in my career, hesitated to speak in a meeting. Now I probably talk too much, but I think it's important for early career and mid-career professionals to really establish themselves. And I learned this from a mentor of mine named Schiffer Bronsnick, who I'm sure some people listening to this will remember that name. She was really, she was the preeminent leader in looking at gender issues in Jewish communal life. And she had started an organization that I was the first program director of called Advancing Women Professionals in the Jewish Community. And we had just been to a JFNA board meeting and we were out to lunch. And of course, I did not say a word at the JFNA board meeting. You know, I was, you know, so far down the totem pole, but there right. was a time at that meeting where we were talking about my work. And she said to me afterwards, she said, "I never want you to leave a meeting again without having said something."
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we set the tone for how people perceive us. If you are just sitting in the meeting, scribbling the notes and getting the coffee, then people are going to perceive that's your role.
Right.
I am very careful still to this day, even as a CEO, about what I choose to do in a meeting.
Mm-hmm. I'm
the person who gets up and takes the lids off the food. Where do I sit? I think all of these things are really calculated decisions and they're not to be taken lightly. I think about how the room's going to be set up before I get there. And how is it going to position me to engage with the group? And then, and this is a thing that I think our colleagues screw up all the time, which is when you're working with a new lay leader, you have to sit down and create a relationship, and you have to create trust with that person, and you have to earn that. And you earn that trust by showing them, here's the value I bring to this relationship. Like, here's how I see my part. Here's how I see your part. And then let's talk amongst ourselves to see if we agree. And then setting a tone for how we're going to engage with each other. You know, in the old days, we used to say to volunteer leadership, oh, we just have to write your name down on the list. Like, you don't have to do anything. Everyone's busier now than they were back in the day. And people's time is limited. And our volunteers actually really want to contribute in a meaningful way.
Right.
And so, like, let's not BS people. Let's say, I need your expertise on this. And this is where I need help and partnership. And this is where I think I can add value and where you can add value. And let's figure out how we work together to do that successfully. And then negotiating with people how you're going to communicate with them. And this is really important, because I think if you're in a lay partnership, you have to be in touch with them. Well, what does that look like? Do they like to get texts every time there's information? Do they want an email? Would they prefer to check in with you once a week, once a month? Do they want you to check in with them every Friday? Here's an update of what I'm working on. I think knowledge is power in this situation. And so being able to keep in communication with your lay leadership about what's going on is important, but you have to figure out, like, what model is going to work for them. And so I think, you know, just to sort of summarize this, like, you are responsible for how you're going to be in that relationship and how you're going to be perceived. And if you come in confident and smart with a plan, you're going to be treated a lot differently than if you don't.
Right. Right. That's a lot to unpack there, huh? You know, immediately what comes to mind, I mean, is just a lot of stuff that I've been struggling with this last few months in, you know, the Brené Brown videos that, I mean, I feel like I keep mentioning this at every conversation. But even in reading Glennon Doyle and listening to some of her sort of podcasts is, you know, this place of leadership in which, you know, her tagline is, I'm not crazy, I'm a goddamn cheetah. And this kind of retraining of being okay with being yourself, but also like taking up your space and saying, like, you know, whether or not you disagree, however you're perceived, that kind of stuff. Like, I'm actually doing really great work and I'm actually a really great professional. And even if we're going through, you know, whatever situation it is, I'm going to continue to claim the sort of power that I have in my role and the confidence that I'm doing a great job, regardless of sort of the feedback and the frustration and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I think it might be easier for generations behind us or our current generation to claim that and to own that. And especially around when, you know, mistakes are made or when, you know, the perception is not what you want it to be, to kind of keep reclaiming that, right? Because it's not something that you're just going to have and is always going to be easy, right? It seems like, and you tell me if I'm wrong, or if you've just always been endowed with the most awesome confidence and part of exactly who you are, really great parents. But, you know, it's just, it seems like it's an ongoing process. I mean, I see, you know, a few things behind you that, you know, I'm sure help you feel happy and confident. I mean, I've got a you know, something on my wall that says, you know, be happy, be bright, be you. And part of that's for me, but part of that's also for other people. And I think for me in this role, I do that so often for my staff in terms of saying, you're so awesome. Don't let the person get you down, right? Is that legitimate criticism about your work? And if it is, let's talk about it. Yeah. If it's that they don't like your hair that day, or you didn't smile enough because you were having a, you know, a bad day for a personal reason, right? Just trying to, you know, I constantly am doing that for my staff and making sure that they have that confidence. And so finding ways for us to, you know, in these roles, constantly be doing that for ourselves, whatever that looks like. If it's, you know, a podcast or things on our walls or, you know, a certain mantra or just some way to continue to reclaim that confidence and that self-esteem and power so that that comes across when we have those conversations and we're in those situations to handle ourselves in a respectful way. Are there other ways that you kind of keep your confidence up or going or like understand your self-worth?
I think, you know, people have asked, I'm very confident, clearly that's come across. And a lot of people have asked me, were you always that confident? Where did it come from? I can't remember, you know, I for the last 20 years? Probably yes.
Right.
I don't know that it was always the case. What I want to say is that I think to some degree, confidence comes from knowing you're doing your best work.
Right.
And so when you can fall back on the fact that you did everything you needed to do to be excellent, it's a lot easier to feel good about it.
Right.
So, you know, and I don't want to stray into the topic of work-life balance, but I'm going to stray a little.
Yeah, go for it.
I won't rest until I've done what I need to do to make something happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes that means I leave here. You know, I have two boys. They're teenagers now. One of them drives. It gets a lot easier when they get to
yes. Easier than 2 and 4? I wasn't sure if it got any easier.
And, you know, I married someone who supported the idea of me having a big career.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something I always tell, you know, really young people who are just starting out. Like, if you have a vision for what you want to achieve in your life, you right. have to choose a partner who is going to be on that journey with you.
Amen.
So I'm putting that out there. It does not work, you know, in other ways. So I have a partner who supports me being in this crazy job and in the other crazy.
I mean, he supported you enough to move to Florida with your teenage children. Yes. So
shout out to Josh. But you know, I do what I need to do. I go home, I make dinner, and then I may work for another 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, there's no boundary between work and life. And I know that some people would sort of argue with me on that approach. But for me, that's what works because it allows me to do, you know, my best work. And it also, by the way, means that when I wake up, I go for a walk. You know, I work right. out every morning. I go out to lunch. If I need to do something at 2 o'clock on my that's personal, yeah. I do it. And I make the choices that support what I need to be the best professional that I can be. But I try to always do my best work, because that's what gives me the confidence to go into a situation where, I can really be confident because I know that I did the work to prepare to be ready
right.
For whatever the thing is. And I own mistakes immediately. And that I did learn the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not going to get out of something,
right.
just own it and move
yeah,
on.
Because totally.
If you take responsibility immediately, like I screwed this up, I missed this thing, I didn't see this thing, I learned from it and I'm moving on. You know, it sort of takes the heat out of the difficult situation. So I also always try to do that. And now I get a little lost from where we started. But the one thing that I did want to say as a CEO, and this is something I've learned and that I talked a lot about when I was interviewing for this job, is that my staff had been pretty beaten up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I inherited them, they, you know, had just been through COVID. Florida is a challenging state, a challenging political climate.
Yeah.
Broward is, you know, the blue square in the state of Florida on CNN. So, you know, there were a lot of sort of challenges, you know, with previous leadership and feelings and personalities that I came into. And I said, when I was interviewing for the job, my priority is going to be getting this team straightened out.
Right.
And we recently had a situation, you know, there's 50 employees here. We're big, but small at the same time. Everybody knows what's going on here.
Right.
And one of my earlier career professionals was dealing with a volunteer and who they felt wasn't treating them with respect. Mm-hmm. The situation was getting a little out of hand. I knew that everybody was paying attention. I saw how it was playing out and the impact it was having on my colleague. And I ultimately had to make the decision in conjunction with leadership to tell that person she was no longer welcome to continue in the role. And that was
this was the staff person or this was the lay person?
The lay person.
Mm. Yay. I'm sorry. I'm sure that was very hard, but yeah,
it was very difficult. She was very gracious. I have never had to do that in my entire career. Mm. And it would have absolutely been the easier thing to just let it go. But
right.
I knew there were repercussions organizationally. I knew there were repercussions for the professional who was doing the work. And so making the choice that I made to relieve this person of their responsibilities, made an awfully big statement, not only to my staff that I had their back, but also to the volunteer leadership, because they know,
again, this is the way you treat staff.
They know that they're, I mean, I did try not to share the details too widely, but like people knew that we'd made the decision for her term to come to completion prematurely, and that there's a backstory to that. So I think when you, when you're up against a wall in a difficult situation like that, and you make this kind of really hard choice, people see it and they learn from it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's when I get the most mama bear. I'm like, deal with me however you want to. We'll figure it out, right? The second you start, you know, treating my staff in a, you know, not great way. And, you know, I think I struggle a lot. You were talking about, you know, work-life balance and time off and how to kind of integrate those things. And I'm very big with that with my staff. You know, so when my leadership starts saying, well, you don't get 4 weeks, you get 2 weeks vacation, or you can't work when the office is closed, even if you wanted to, you have to, and I'm like, whoa, like, you know, that's when I get very defensive in terms of, you know, decisions about your staff, and that there's privileges that, yes, senior staff members should have, but also that everybody as human beings should have in terms of the autonomy they have over their life and that balance. And I kind of talk a lot on this program with people about that, because like you said, I mean, it's just, some people are morning people, some people are evening people, some people do their best work when there's nobody in the building and it's quiet, some people really want to rest when everyone else is resting. I mean, it's just everyone's so different, and allowing space for that instead of the rigid, like, there's a reason people aren't working. Last time I said Sears and that didn't work out so well because nobody works for Sears. You know, people are working for Walmart. I mean, in terms of being in a corporate environment, like, there's something to being in a nonprofit, and, you know, you taking that step to say, you know, our staff are respected in at this, you know, basic level and leading with these values. I mean, that's why people go to work for Jewish nonprofits, is the assumption that there's some level of, you know, Jewish values that are being expressed in a really important way, that, you know, I was going to say that you don't get sexually harassed. I wouldn't say that nobody gets sexually harassed in the Jewish community, but maybe less likely. I don't know. Maybe it's a bad example, but I think there's, you know, a lot to be said with really leading with values. And I don't know if that's, you know, so easy for people, but that sort of power dynamic between lay and professional, that, you know, you have to treat each other with that level of respect. And when there, you know, is a conflict, if you can't figure it out, then, like, then some space, right? Then a different role, then somewhere that maybe fits a little better for you, a better partner in this work that we can sort of shuffle, that we can figure out. But to allow that kind of stuff to continue, especially in a leadership position that you know is unhealthy, you know, it's easier just to let it continue, but it's, you know, the right thing. And it's harder to say, this isn't what our organization is about, and let's fix this.
Right. I also think, you know, and this is a thing we did in Chicago, is we set expectations for lay leadership at the beginning of each year. You know, these are the expectations of you as a board member. Mm-hmm. And one of the expectations is treating everybody with respect, you know, your fellow lay leadership as well as professional leadership. And I do think the CEO sets a tone in how they talk about their colleagues, and how they treat everybody. And that helps to inform how the rest of the organization behaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was talking about that at the beginning of our training program. We had talked about, I'm trying to remember what initially was about, just different, like, values, really, that we were kind of talking about within the program. And I mentioned that, like, the thing that I really struggle with at times is the respect and the kind of lashon hara, like, talking about stuff. And part of one of my sort of life goals for moving forward, I use this app called Done, which is just like a bunch of habit tracking. And one of them is, like, radiating positivity. And I'm like, okay, it's so hard. So, like, it's easier when somebody does something annoying to go to your colleague and be like, oh my gosh, this person did this super annoying thing. Can you believe it? I can't believe they did this. And although it feels like you're creating this relationship with this person in sort of the, not as a common enemy, but, like, you know, in this sort of drama way, that, you know, just really isn't that productive. And I think you can get into a habit with colleagues that don't perpetuate this positivity. And as a leader, you're, like you said, you're setting the tone. And so if somebody comes to you and is like, oh my God, this person did this and that person done that, you said, okay, that sounds really challenging. You know, how can we move this forward? Or what's worse? It's like, oh my God, I can't believe that person did that. Oh, that's the worst. I'm so sorry that happened to you. Because I think there's just a natural tendency to do that in sort of the relationship building with your staff and with your, you know, your lay leaders, that, you know, being the person that sets the tone in that regard, it can be challenging. It's a challenge for me, for what I'm sharing. And it, you know, especially when you're talking about, really stick out for me about the way you show up to meetings. And so because we're small and I'm, you know, the first executive director, when I started here, we started a board meeting and I was like, we should have snacks. Why shouldn't we have snacks? And so, of course, I'm the one that went shopping for snacks and I'm the one that was putting out snacks and I was the one who was cleaning up snacks. And the precedent and the image that that gave about my role here wasn't great, even though in the meeting, right, I'm talking about this thing and I'm talking about that thing and I'm backing up this leader with their question. I'm getting this answer, and that during the meeting, I'm very much, you know, a leader in this community. I'm still then picking up your dirty coffee cup. And although for me, I'm like, all hands on deck, I don't care. Like, I take care of this building as much as anybody else. You know, the perception is that I'm the person who's picking up the coffee cups. And so, you know, I never really thought about it more in depth than just, I wanted to provide snacks so that they had an enjoyable board experience. But, you know, kind of really, especially for our earlier career professionals, getting that support, right? Getting somebody else to do the snacks, thinking about who you're sitting next to, thinking about not only just that you're participating, but when you participate, right? So you're going to sit there in the meeting, you're going to have a million thoughts and ideas, you're like, oh, this, or maybe this, or maybe I'm going to say this. And like really being, you know, strategic about what it is that you say, when it is you say it, make sure it's, you know, sharing value. And, you know, that perception is reality. And that, you know, for me has been a challenge here because I like doing the behind the scenes stuff. And I like that there's the rabbi that, you know, stands in the podium and says the interesting, smart thing, and that I've, you know, take pride in that I've created this experience for people. But that perception is still something that, you know, that I struggle with. But you seem to have, you know, whether it's from a mentor or your own, you know, experience, said like that perception is really important. And specifically around the space of meetings, you know, I need to make sure that I'm showing up in a way that projects what I want to have projected.
Right. And I think there's a way to say it too. Like, have you considered this angle? Or here's something that I've seen has worked in other places. Or, you know, there's a way to say to get yourself in as part of the conversation that feels respectful. And here, I want to go back to something you said about the snacks. I'm going to give a shout out to a colleague in Chicago because I want all the men on this call to hear this. And a colleague in Chicago who was senior to me. Whatever his title was, senior vice president, chief operating officer, whatever, it changed a couple times, but he was senior to me. But I did governance and lay leadership development. So I was always the one planning the meetings because that was my job. But he always volunteered to get the coffee or to clean up. And he did that because he knew that if he was cleaning up, nobody was thinking, or he brought the coffee, nobody was confusing his role.
Nope.
It was clear he was at the top of the food chain and he was a man. And what I have actually found recently, I had very positive supports in that respect in Chicago, though of course it wasn't perfect. Here, and these are not my colleagues, but other people I've been interacting, maybe peer CEOs in other Jewish organizations who I spend a lot of time with or in other federations, I'm not seeing that same sort of leadership from the men. And it's not lost on me that I'm the only woman federation CEO in South Florida. My three colleagues are men who are all great, who I adore, but I was still the one planning the meal for when the four of us got together. Right. So I do feel, especially from younger colleagues or more similarly aged colleagues, you know, I want to see the other guy say, you know what, I got it.
Yeah.
Because they should know how it's perceived when they don't make that choice. And so for all the men out there, you know, be an ally, be an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that we often hear is that a woman suggests something and no one hears it. And then the man suggests it and everyone's like, oh, yay, what a good idea.
So that actually happened to me. And I was like floored in this meeting where I was like, oh, that just happened. Like that just happened to me. Oh, my God.
A man who has your back in that conversation wouldn't
let that happen. Right.
That's a great idea, Bob. And it was great when Michelle suggested it earlier in the meeting, too.
Yeah. But that's also to understand that they're actually cognizant, right? Like I'm sitting in that meeting. This happens to me in a room of, you know, three people. Now, mm-hmm. I can't assume that the person who made the suggestion I just said even is aware that I said it, or the person who actually was like, that's a great idea, was like, hold on a second. Like, so I'm like, yes. And sometimes I'm really sensitive to, you know, them not even understanding that. I mean, there was a lay leader I was working with and I was trying so hard to help explain to him what my situation was like, what it was like sitting in my seat as a female leader. And I just, no matter what I did, like he could not understand it and could not grasp it. And I can't so much fault them for that, because I think there are younger colleagues who would be more sensitive to that, who would be more of an advocate, who would notice it. You know, there was a point in my role here in which, you know, my rabbi is a man, my president's a man, the first vice president's a man, my finance vice president's a man. And those are mostly the people that I work with most of the time. And so, you know, there was a point where I was, you know, sending them all emails about decision stuff. And I was like, I'm really sick of just reporting to men. And I looked at the board and I said, hey, you awesome female leader, you know, there's this leadership gap. Are you interested? Is that something you'd be interested in taking over? Because I'd really like a woman in the room with me in terms of just, you know, that's for me, that's the person who's going to call that out. Right. For me, that's the person who's going to say, and not always, right? Females are not always so kind to other females either. But, you know, I think that, you know, my role, you know, in this is also trying to find women in leadership, and they might not have the confidence to say, you know, I could be the president of a synagogue, to say, hey, you could be a president of a synagogue. Have you thought about that? Or the board chair, or the first female, you know, board chair for JPRO, or, you know, elsewhere. I think there's, you know, some lifting up that kind of goes along with those gender dynamics that, you know, I try not to hold men too accountable for. You know, my husband thankfully is the one more attuned to it than others, but I try to give a little bit of grace in those situations. But yeah, I was pretty floored when that happened to me. I was like, I read about this in books. It's like seeing a zebra or something. I was just like, oh my God. But right.
I think we have to elevate. We have to take responsibility for elevating women's leadership and helping them see what's possible. The truth is, I never thought about being a CEO. It was never something I wanted. It was never something I thought I wanted. And after Steve Nassiter announced that he was stepping down as CEO, a very senior colleague in our field, I was at a conference, said to me, you know, any one of you who worked for Steve could be a CEO. And I thought, huh, like, why did no one tell me that before?
Right.
And
right.
When I had to tell Steve, who I am deeply devoted to, who is a mentor of mine, who is also flawed.
We all are.
I'm still deeply devoted to him. And when I was telling him that I was a finalist for this job, I was really afraid that he was going to say, what? Like, you're the CEO? Like, and he was actually really amazing and has continued to be amazing. But like, why didn't he tell me 10 years ago, you know, Audra, this is something I could see you in. Like, why don't you think about this for your future? And that didn't happen.
Right.
And so it didn't. And now that I'm here, I sort of see all the ways I was looking to do more, you know, through JPRO was a big way. I was in Wexner, so there was that. So I was looking for ways to shine and to advance.
Right.
But
right.
This never seemed like a possibility. And now that I'm in this job, I will tell you, first of all, my community is just thrilled that I'm a woman. They're incredibly happy. They're incredibly proud of themselves. They love to say right afterwards, you know, but she was also the best person for the job.
Are you their first female CEO?
I am.
All right. Look at you, trailblazing. Yeah,
there are not many women CEOs in larger federations. The smaller the federation, the more likely chance there is to be a woman, because they're smaller budget organizations and more dysfunctional. In my peer,
so they can pay the women less. It's all great.
Yes. Oh, yeah. In my peer CEO group of large intermediate federation execs, there's a good amount of women in the largest. There's only two, and Cleveland and San Francisco. And they're both, you know, newer in the role.
Right.
It's a lot of men that sit in that room. But one of the things I do in this job that I have a great, feel like I have a great responsibility for is saying, like, let's look at this committee and hello, boys, there's only one woman on this list. We can't have a committee with all, so sort of raising and elevating it and making it a lens through which you make decisions. And, you know, I was raised that way. And now we're also looking at things, not just through a gender lens, but through a diversity lens. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of ways to sort of look at how we think about leadership. And it's hard in the Jewish community, but there is diversity out there and we have to figure out a way to integrate it into our decision making.
Yeah. I mean, it's a developer is one of my top five Clifton strengths. And it's just like, for me, it's just the best when it comes to staff or leadership, you know, someone who's not on the board, be like, have you thought about board service? Or, you know, I have a colleague here who has been here for 20 years. And, you know, there was a rabbi here who was less than excellent in his culture creating. But, you know, when I started, I was like, okay, let's talk about your role. What do you do? I changed her title to be a little more appropriate because she was just, you know, her name. She didn't even have a title. She was just the person in the office, right? No one kind of knew what she did. And I subsequently sort of helped her to realize, like, you have a lot of skills and you can do a lot of things. And, you know, supporting that development in a way that now she's a director level position. But then you have, you know, sort of the culture and the perception of like, well, no, she's the office person to change around, like, nobody's just the blank, right? And even, you know, staff on any level, you know, there's always room for growth or not. Maybe they're like super happy where they're at and that's the only job that they want to be doing and they don't want to grow. But finding those people, and that's, you know, my strength in terms of things that I find joy with is finding those people, finding what makes them tick, what, you know, makes them feel joy in their work and developing that and saying, you're actually worth a lot more than you've been told that you're worth and worth a lot more than you think that you're worth. And let's figure that out together on sort of all areas. And so on the more positive lay professional relationship side, that's what we get to do in these roles. Like somebody who's a, you know, director of engagement for you doesn't really get to do that with, you know, a lay leader in terms of it would come off a little more weird to be like, what do you, why is this coming from you? You know, and I think that's a joy of our roles on the sort of positive relationship side that we get to help develop that and develop that confidence and help them feel belonging in the organization that they're, you know, productive in your work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're wrapping up. The other thing I wanted to mention in what you had talked about before was the, you know, you mentioned something about like where you needed help in these relationships. And I think also with these CEO roles, that's challenging in terms of like you're coming in. I mean, you talked about the like 12 different areas you had to have expertise in to lead in, to really be, you know, humble enough in a position to say, okay, I don't actually, you know, have expertise in this, or I really need help in this. And although intrinsically it feels like weakness, right? Intrinsically it feels like, well, you're the CEO. You shouldn't need that much help. You should be able to do all the things we need you to do. I think showing that vulnerability to lay leadership and saying, hey, you come with me, help me figure this thing out together. How else has that showed up for you in terms of like that vulnerability to ask for help to make others feel valued in the work and not just like, oh no, I've got it. Don't worry. Like I'll take care of everything, which is obviously not sustainable.
Right. I think, you know, I've tried to own, you know, what I'm not good at, you know, when I was interviewing for the position, you know, we have a significant real estate and investment portfolio. You know, I don't know it. That is right. Not my area. Like I did not get into Jewish communal work to deal with. And the first year, truthfully, of my job, a lot of the challenges that I had to deal with, we own a campus. with the largest footprint JCC in the country, a K-12 day school, our family service agency, a home healthcare agency, and it's ours.
Right.
And there were a lot of challenges in the relationships and parking and traffic. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've literally spent 6 months worth of time navigating the parking spot.
Right.
And so I have tried to add people to my team who have that expertise and to lean into it. And when I'm in a call, I'm happy to defer to my colleagues. I have an amazing CFO. I still can't understand, you know, all of it, all of the angles of our portfolio and our investment strategy. And I say, talk to Heather.
Right.
Heather's got that one. And so I do try to lift my colleagues up and lean into that. And, you know, it's always going to be okay to say, I don't have an answer to that right now, or that's something I'm still figuring out. Because it isn't realistic to be good at everything.
Yeah, definitely not. So wonderful. So as we come to the end, we kind of covered a lot of ground. You already covered your work-life balance for me and, you know, some of the things I might have asked, you know, a lot of advice for people in the field. You know, any kind of last comments of the stuff that we've talked about, power dynamic issues, just, you know, general leading in the Jewish community, direction of the Jewish community. I feel like we could keep talking for another hour, but unfortunately.
Yeah. I would just say that, like, you have to love this work to do it and be successful. It is hard, challenging work with a lot of demands in a complicated time. And if you don't love it, find the thing you love, because you have to love it to be successful at it and to have that positive energy and authenticity. And I just, you know, I feel so fortunate to really have just fallen into something that I feel so passionate about and that has brought me such joy in my professional life. And if this isn't your thing, go off and find your thing, because everyone deserves to have the kind of satisfaction that I've had in my career. And it's, everyone doesn't always get so lucky. So find that thing that makes you happy and that you can do with excellence.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Audra. Really appreciate the conversation. Excited to share these with your colleagues and people out there in the field. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle. It was fun.
Like this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com. or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.